Hello, and welcome back to Slut PhD. I am your host, Julie Fennell, and today I am here with my dear friend and co-author, Remy Green, to talk about our book, Violated. And I'm going to let Remy briefly introduce themselves real fast.
Hi, Julie. My name is Remy Green. I'm a civil rights lawyer, erstwhile legal scholar, and it's really great to be here.
Awesome. Do want to say at the start that obviously our book, as you will know if you've read, or sorry, if you've listened to the episode where I read chapter one out loud, this is a book about rape and sexual assault. So in terms of trigger warnings, there's, you know, a lot. Please always, when addressing these types of topics, be kind to yourself. I think that we have a lot to say about this, but that doesn't mean that, you know, you have to absorb it all in a single sitting, even if it's something that you really care about. This can be a lot to take in. It was a lot for me to take in while I was writing. So just be aware of that. I wanted to start by talking about how we came to write this book. So the story of writing this book begins many, 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 many years ago for me. I want to think it was in 2014, and I was dating a woman who is a public defender, who, if you're from another country, means she's a lawyer who works for people for free. Like, she's free legal aid, basically, that's paid for by the government. And in America, if you're a public defender, you are in court all day, every day. And it's a busy, busy job. And I was always really fascinated by her job because I never actually really wanted to be a lawyer, but I wanted to be like a lawyer on TV type of lawyer. And so I would talk to her a lot about her job. And I don't remember how it came up one day, but she was talking to me about sexual assault and rape. And also she was talking about murder, because I think she actually was possibly defending someone who wasn't murdered for homicide charges at the time. I don't remember. But anyway, somehow it comes up in the course of our conversation that a homicide, in America at least, is this incredibly sophisticated, graded offense where there's like first degree and second degree, but this is all about like intentionality, and like there's even special charges sometimes for like you didn't intend to kill somebody, but like what you did was really stupid, and these like all these different things, which Remy will get to. And when I turn the microphone over to them, so she's telling me all about this, and I was like, so, but do they do that for rape? She goes, no, it's really dumb, isn't it? And I was like, so it's not like graded at all? She said, no. And we just keep talking about how incredibly stupid this is. She and I eventually part ways amicably, and she goes on to become a very famous public defender who's famous for her work with Indigenous people. And then a few months later, I meet Remy, and Remy is about to go to law school at the time.
Well, no, I was in law school.
You were in law school.
I was in law school, yeah.
Yeah, Remy was in law school at the time, and I was like, hey, so I really want to write this book, but I'm a sociologist and I don't know shit about the law, so I really need a lawyer to help me co-write it, and you seem queer and cool. What do you think of this concept? And they were like, I am so on board with this. So this starts in like 2014. We pitched the book in 2019, initially no luck, and also then 2020 happened, so everything just kind of goes to bits. And then in one of the most bizarre, fortuitous moments of my life, I was signing books for my previous book on the BDSM scene at a convention, and someone just jokingly asks me while I'm signing their book, they're like, so what's your next book gonna be? And I was like, I don't know, I had this book about rape and consent, but nobody wanted it. And my publisher overhears me saying this. I had, until this person mentioned it to me, forgotten that I had done this, because it had been 3 or 4 years at this point. And
no,
she
I've certainly forgotten.
Right. I had totally forgotten about it. And I like happened to remember it as this person asks me jokingly, what's your next book going to be? I was like, well, but nobody wanted it. And my publisher's like, oh, I want to read it. And I said, okay, I'll send you the book proposal later today. And they were super on board with it, which was such a delightful change and extra funny because the people who had been the most promising for us initially were like connected to that publisher and they had turned it down. So Remy, why don't you give your side of this?
Yeah, you know, where my life is now, I'm a practicing lawyer. I do some academic stuff, but I, you know, am very much a day-to-day litigator doing civil rights cases. When we first started talking about this, I was very much thinking I was going to be just a pure academic and had just come out of, you know, I think a very weird experience in taking criminal law classes in law school where I had a very thoughtful professor. I like him a lot. I think he's brilliant in certain ways, but also like had a, I think, bad experience learning rape law in large part because of some things that were going on in the community that was learning this stuff. Without getting too much into it, I think, you know, there is a literature about how to teach rape law. And, you know, one of the things that he'd done as kind of a thought experiment was, we talk about in the book, the Antioch sexual assault policy that, you know, a local school sexual assault policy that fits into the some liberal arts school somewhere did something weird, and that's a national crisis.
this was a long time ago for those of you who are younger. Yeah,
although that pattern has not changed.
No.
We're so concerned about what one student does at Oberlin in terms of national speech crises. But apparently, you know, when the government does it, it's fine.
Yeah.
So at any rate, you know, I spent a lot of time in law school thinking about, you know, the ways that both the law itself and the conversations we have around it were kind of just fundamentally weird. and like it really seemed like, you know, the way we treat rape and sexual assault law doesn't match anything else in the criminal law and is uniquely focused on kind of the victim's state of mind and things like that, as opposed to, as Julie was alluding to, the way that like there is, you know, in United States law, there are 50 different or 51 really different criminal laws. But across those very, very, very broadly, murder and homicide law are very stratified around what somebody means and like how wrongful we think their conduct is. And I think that is not exactly true in rape law. And so that kind of was the idea that we were kicking around when we first started writing the book. You know, when we first started writing this, I was an associate at a mega firm, and this was kind of a like, okay, this is a cool thing to do to kind of maybe drum up some business, maybe kind of get my name out there in certain other ways. And since then, I started a civil rights firm, and my life is completely different. And that's when we got the deal to write the book. Once I'd kind of moved away from this as something I was actively doing, so it was. I don't know. It was a strange experience writing it, certainly.
It was very odd for me in the sense of, like, I think sociology as a discipline tends to be pretty skeptical about the idea that the law means much. And so I kind of was trained, I guess, with a little bit of this feeling that the law is nothing more than a reflection of what society believes. And I think also feminist groups over time have also come to be increasingly skeptical about how helpful the law is.
So, to be fair, that perspective exists within legal scholarship as well.
Absolutely. I mean, it's a completely understandable perspective. You know, one of the things that I really wrestled with as I was writing the book was the degree to which I agreed with that. And mostly I tend to come down on the side of, well, it's both. I think you can really see that best reflected.
I mean, Julie, you could be a lawyer already. You're saying it depends.
I know. Well, that's a sociology thing to do, too. And that's the thing is that sociology and law have a lot in common. It's not uncommon for disillusioned sociologists to go get law degrees. And
it's like, not uncommon for disillusioned lawyers to go get sociology degrees.
You get disillusioned with different things.
You just need something else, a different kind of stupid in your life.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think also some of it's about money and some of it's about pragmatism. And some of I think a competition between pragmatism and idealism is a lot of what's going on there. At least that's my hypothesis. I think that as I kept writing it, I kept coming back to findings. I think it might have even been in an XKCD comic where it had shown up this graph about when interracial marriage became legal in the United States, which was, I think, I want to say 1973. It might have been 72.
I should know that. I should know when Loving was decided.
Yeah, Loving versus Virginia. And then the point at which the majority
67, by the way.
Oh, it's so much earlier than I thought. Okay. And then the point at which the majority of Americans came to support interracial marriage, which didn't happen until the mid-90s. Like, the graph doesn't cross the majority line until the mid-90s. And then how the opposite had happened for gay marriage. I mean, it wasn't so far removed in terms of time, but like the majority of Americans had supported gay marriage well before the Supreme Court came to rule and say that it was the law of the land. And I thought it was really interesting because I felt like that showed how it could go in either direction. That, in fact, the law does influence the way people think, but also obviously the way people think influences the law. But the other thing that really poked at me a lot as I was writing this is information about how people feel, how many people don't care about things that we often think are important, right? So like the actual majority of Americans don't have strong opinions about abortion, which is something that blows the minds of people who care a lot about it in either direction, right? But like most people, even in the era where gay marriage wasn't legal, they did studies and showed that you could change their minds in a remarkably short period of time because most people just don't have very strongly held opinions about a lot of things. And so I think when you're talking about anything where people just haven't thought about it very much, the law has a pretty big influence on how they feel. Another study that I ran across while I was doing this research was that the majority of Americans still support the idea that you should have to be 21 to buy alcohol, which I was like, wait, what? Are you kidding me? Most people support this law. Like, numbers show that almost everyone drinks before they're 21. And yet they're saying they think it should be 21. And yet that is what they think. And then also in the same study found that most Americans believe that you should have to be 18 to have sex. Under the law, basically. Right. And I was like, are you fucking kidding me? The average age to lose your virginity is 17. Like, to be clear, it's not to have sex. Sorry. It's the age of consent, right?
So,
which is different.
Yeah.
Related.
No, that doesn't seem like I mean, we'll get into it, I'm sure, a little later, but
It's a weird, well, just so you know, especially if you're listening from another country, in most American states, the age of consent is actually 16, but
unless you're married.
Right. But the fascinating thing about that is that when I go around casually talking to people about this, I almost never meet anyone who knows this. Like, it is very rare, even in academic circles, to encounter people who know that the age of consent is not 18 in a lot of American states. And so I think a lot of why people think the age of consent should be 18 is because that's what they believe it is. And so one of the things that I came to believe, which I don't necessarily have a fantastic way to back up, except in all of these vaguely related data forms here, is that when people don't have well-formed opinions about something, the law becomes the thing that guides their opinion, right? I mean, obviously religion comes into this as well. But if it's not something that you sit around thinking about all the time every day, you're like, oh, well, maybe these people who bothered to make a law about it have some sense about the way this thing works. And so I started to think more and more that if we could change the law, about some of these things. First of all, in order to be able to change the law in the first place, you'd have to convince people to feel a certain way and believe certain set of things.
Also, I mean, we should also kind of draw some distinction there, and we will get into it, I'm sure, between, you know, criminal legal sanctions at one end of the spectrum and kind of moral opprobrium on the other end of the spectrum, and maybe something like civil liability somewhere in between.
Yeah, I think that really came to be a big theme for our book, and it's even in the introduction, because I was like, there were plenty of people who will never read anything but the first chapter of this book. What would I like them to think about? And one of the big things that we talked about a lot as we were conceptualizing it was this difference between what do you want to be against the law? And what do you want to be against morality? And, you know, it turns out that those things aren't always the same thing. But oftentimes the law does provide the clothes hangers upon which we hang the clothes of the rest of that. And so it's true that, especially in more religious societies, religion can provide more of that clothes hanger. But in a modern society where more people are more and more non-religious, I think a lot of times the law does provide the clothes hangers for people's morality, even when they think the law is stupid. And so that was another reason why I felt like it was worth our time to really push to change the law here about sexual assault. And not just to change the law, but really to change, as Remy was talking about, sort of the foundation of it, right? Like, we felt like the basic fundamental way that it was structured was flawed.
And, you know, not to suggest we're the only people who think this.
We are not. Like, we found an article that had been published in 2019, although, and it was arguing for exactly the same thing. You know, other people, was it 2019? I was trying to look for it while we were talking for the citation. I'll put it in the link under, to link to that, we were not the first people to say this. Although remarkably few have, even in legal journals.
I mean, remarkably few have really proposed. I mean, the project of reform in law, you have to approach it in different ways. And I think kind of a structural getting 51 sources of law to completely redefine one of the like three major offenses is not necessarily a project that has much, call it, chance for success.
Yeah, but I mean, I was shocked as I did this research about how much European laws weren't better. I had started off with the notion of like, oh, but maybe European laws are doing a better job with this than American laws are. First of all, those are hard comparisons to make because oftentimes the whole structure of the laws differ by countries. But they really aren't. And I really had expected, as I kept digging, to be able to find somewhere that had a model code, right? That we could just like go there as the place that had solved this problem. And I assumed that it was in like one of these gender equal countries like Sweden or something. And then it turns out Sweden has the highest rate of sexual assault in the world reported, right? Which is a tricky statistic.
Yeah, I mean, this is, call it, the like legal realist versus sociologist fight that we had a million times writing this book, which is all of the data in this area is at least to me, hard to buy, because how are you getting your data?
Oh, yeah. I feel like one of the worst things for me as a sociologist writing this book, and sociologists often worship at the altar of data. It's kind of what we do. And the data were so shit. I mean, I don't want to be critical of anybody who's working this area to be listening to this episode, but I'm sure if you are working in this area, you are more aware than anybody.
You're probably screaming louder than we are right now.
Right.
These are hard problems, and it's, you know, taking two studies from different countries and trying to compare them is, I think, foolhardy, right? You've made different assumptions. You've addressed problems in how you're collecting data differently. You're asking different people. You have different social norms about how much people are willing to say to somebody conducting a survey. Like, the data are just not comparable.
Well, and they also compare like the reports to the police, which is more complicated in these terms. For sure.
And it's not like any of these countries have different systems of policing or different social feelings about the police, perhaps.
Yeah. But, you know, at the same time, there I did run across a couple of good international sociological analyses that were showing oftentimes remarkable similarity in trends, even across developed and less developed countries over time. And that was very surprising to me as well, of like, oh, these same types of things have been going on. And so, you know, one of the big things themes that shows up in that research is lots of countries having big rape law reforms in the 90s. And everybody hoping that this would change things. But in fact, consistently across so many places, there were more reported rapes. Like it didn't make things better the way that they had hoped it would. But then they were like, oh, but is this just because now more people are reporting it because they feel more comfortable? They didn't know what to make of what was going on there, but they did find a lot of similarities.
Or more conduct was likely to result in a conviction, right? Like,
well, no, that was another thing, is that rape conviction rates had gone down all over.
Sure.
And so then it was like, oh, are just people reporting more rapes that are less serious? And that's, so it's harder to get a conviction.
Sorry, that is exactly what I was trying to say.
It is
prosecutors,
weird.
You know, having law reform on their side, bringing more cases that then, you know, in jury trial systems, at least people are saying, well, that shouldn't be a rape conviction.
Right. But it was weird and interesting to see that across a lot of different contexts, not just English speaking contexts, right? But a lot of different contexts, that these same types of trends were emerging. But there's no one, as far as I could tell, who has enough nuanced, sophisticated data to really break out what's happening. And when I first started writing the book, one of the plans that I had, I was like, well, this is getting so frustrating. I'm just going to try to calculate some of this myself. And because I do know how to do that. And the problem is like, there's just nowhere to go for that information. Like, right. I would probably have to spend the rest of my life banging on the doors of various courthouses in America trying to get this information that they wouldn't want to give me, and it would suck. And so, yeah, it was very frustrating to me how problematic a lot of these data were in America and in other countries as well. So another thing that we really were tackling as we were writing the book is ideas and themes around gender, which is something that I've researched my entire career. But for me, the thing that was so frustrating when I would talk to people about anything to do with rape as a social thing was the degree to which people would just be indignant about the idea that this was something that men did to women. And I was like, but our entire social construction of the way that dating and sexual norms works is like men pursue and women are pursued. And as long as that is the case, it would be shocking if the vast majority of people who experienced rape as survivors/victims were not women, because they're the people on the receiving end of those advances. And people seem to constantly not understand how much that gendered construction influences that experience, right? Like, you create a set of social norms where you put women and men into these very specific situations. So this is always going to be the outcome more. That said, I found statistics over and over again that say that men get their consent violated so much more than we believe that they do. And then I think that the two things together really create a pretty hostile degree of mistrust going on in a lot of heterosexual interactions. And some of that is just my queer experiences, because I've seen so much in so many different gendered arrangements of the way that people interact with one another, in terms of like who makes advances and who receives. And also, I spend a lot of time talking to straight cis men about how terrible women have been to them, which is always a grim conversation. But, you know, I think as a society in America, but I think also, again, in other countries, we just tend to assume that rape is something that happens to women. And the law says that, to be clear.
Well, certainly the foundations of the law, you know, the model law that a lot of current rape law is, and again, like, very hard to speak in generality, so if you're going to hear me jump in every single time Julie says the law is this way and say, well, there are 51 different systems.
There are. In America, and then in America, other countries as well.
In America alone, right? And the one of the model laws that many states' rape laws are based on defines rape by, say, rape, you know, sexual violation of a woman, not his spouse. So only men, only men can commit rape. Rape doesn't exist within a marriage, and only women can be victims of rape. And that's and there's an implied cis in front of each of those.
There is.
But that, you know, that's the legal groundwork for where we are. And I think, you know, as Julie was alluding to earlier, in the 90s, we kind of shaved off the serial numbers and tried to make everything gender neutral. But that is the groundwork. And you know, I think the vast majority, if not all states, have changed that now, but that doesn't change the kind of historical lineage or the social perception.
Well, also in the construction of most of those laws, it still specifies that men have to be penetrated in order to constitute like a rape or sexual violation. And then when we ask the question right, we find that the vast majority of sexual violations of men are, unsurprisingly, them being forced to penetrate. Right. And so we're just like brushing over what most sexual violations of men look like. And on top of that, like we're saying, it's just not really built into the foundation of the thing anyway. Interestingly, there's been way more of a conversation about this in the literature in England, I found, like when I was researching, because I was trying to research as broadly as I could, given my linguistic limitations, which is to say I mostly only can read English. And I found a pretty lively conversation about trying to change rape laws in England to make it more possible for men to be raped, which I believe was eventually done, but this was relatively recent. And still finding, like, you know, almost nobody reports this. And usually when they do, they're mostly like men who've been raped by other men, right? Like that's who shows up to report it to the police. And very little, unsurprisingly, again, of men reporting being raped by a woman to the police, which, you know, I've had so many conversations with men over my life who I've dated a lot of times who had been raped by women, in one case at gunpoint. And so I was really, that had been my experience, but I kept thinking, oh, maybe this is just the men I know, right? They're queer, they're kinky. Like, this is a very specific subgroup of men. And then as I would look more into the statistics of the thing, even from the CDC, I found far more equality in the reports of men's sexual assault than we as a society tend to credit, even and especially, I would say, most academics would not quote it that way. And it really came down to people ignoring the section of the survey where men were forced to penetrate, right? And which isn't surprising because the law mostly doesn't regard that as sexual assault. And so it becomes this cycle.
I think this is probably a good point to kind of do a little legal mechanics.
Go for it.
You know, we're speaking in broad terms, and I'm going to reduce a vast network of complexity into some broad strokes that may not be exactly true anywhere, but is a finger painting version of the complexity of 50 states and federal law. But broadly speaking, most states define as something like rape or first degree sexual assault as penetration with either a penis or a foreign object of the vagina, or the vagina and the anus. And, you know, I'm just going to be clinical with my terminology here. Then kind of push one tier down, violation of the mouth and things like that. And then another tier down, you know, touching of breasts, involuntary touching with somebody's hands of a penis or a vagina, that sort of thing, or the anus. And the law is structured in gradations that way, usually defining the top, you know, the pure rape, let's call it, which is of penal violation of a vagina or anus, or sometimes like in New York, only a vagina, as rape or as first degree sexual assault, and then as kind of some form of sexual misconduct is usually the term, or sexual violation, or sexual assaults in the second degree or something like that is touching somebody on a sex organ unwantedly. And so when Julie is saying that it's not illegal or it's not covered by the criminal law, that's not exactly what she means. What she's really saying is it's not covered by like the top level felony, and often, you know, digital sexual assault, let's call it, is often just a misdemeanor. So it's not even in the same category. Rarely in practice will it result in jail time. And you also run into occasionally some jury nullification problems around that, which we can get into a little later. But I just want to kind of talk about that. And then I know we've referred to how murder law is structured. Murder law, the terms are homicide and murder, and they're often stratified in the same ways. But the differences are not because of the exact conduct. They are about whether it was planned in advance, whether it was intentional, and whether it was deliberate, right? With kind of accidental deaths that were reckless or negligent in some form sitting at the bottom, and an intentional pre-planned in advance deaths sitting at the top at murder. Or murder one, or, you know, whatever the jurisdiction happens to call it. And, you know, I think that kind of also previews that the proposal we have in the book is that we should really not be stratifying by what is the physical act, and kind of having this, you know, baseball definition, let's call it, of rape, where it matters whether you got to first base, second base, or a home run. In what charges we're leveling or civil penalties we're leveling. And instead, right, it should, like murder, really turn on what did you mean to do and why did you mean to do it?
Yeah, and I also was shocked as I was doing this research to find that in quite a number of American states, as well as still several European countries, that non-consensual sex isn't entirely illegal. Right. Like the law... The way Remy phrased it, which I think shows up in the book, was that essentially violence has often been a substitute for premeditation in the way that American and European countries have constructed rape laws. And so if you do not have violence, then in so many places you do not have rape. And there's been a lot of campaigns to change that. So like in Germany, I want to say like 2016, 2017, there's a really big case that got a lot of international attention around this. There was a big campaign about no means no and changing the law to try to reform that. And a lot of places have reformed that, especially in the wake of the Me Too movement in 2017. But it's not by any means a certainty that you live in a state where just non-consensual sex is illegal. And I didn't even know that when I started writing the book. And in fact, I was about halfway through the book, I think, before I found out that this was true. And I was like, wait, what? Because the federal law in America says that's true. But it turns out the federal law, I learned from Rennie, doesn't apply in a lot of cases.
Right.
And so it's not always that helpful. So as we kept talking about the idea of intentionality and the way that it should figure into legal grading of our approach to sexual assault, one of the things that I started thinking more about was what we came to call consent hygiene, which to me is representative of how to apply that same kind of grading idea into a non-legal context. I mean, it could also influence the legal context, but one of the things that really had come to bother me as I was trying to talk to people, especially in the wake of the Me Too movement, was the way that like people would get labeled as rapists, and they had not all done the same, in my mind, level of bad thing. And so I was like, I think we need to be able to have a lot more nuance in both our conversation and in our approach to this. And I was like, okay, if you think about hygiene and what we tell people to wash their hands, sure, we try to give people a rule that's like, oh, you're supposed to stand there with soap and water under the faucet for 20 seconds and wash your hands every time after you use the bathroom. And I'm going to go out on a limb here and say that I don't think most people actually do that. Like, having been in public restrooms, I don't think that most people, every time they go to the bathroom, actually do that. We understand
the real crisis in public restrooms.
We understand that this is something that we're quote unquote supposed to do. But the reality is, I think most of us grow up learning to apply more context and nuance to that, right? So it's like, are you going to be preparing food for other people in a restaurant? If the answer is yes, then you'd better be pretty careful about this, right? But if you're not doing that, then maybe less caution is required. If you got shit on your hands while you were wiping your ass, maybe more care is required than if you just happened to move your jeans a little bit so that you could piss, right? Like, we understand, I think, on some level, that the amount of hand washing required depends on the circumstances. And while we might say, ideally, everybody would wash their hands with soap for 20 seconds every time we go to the bathroom, like, we understand that, A, that's just not going to happen, and B, that the context really should affect what is the most practical and reasonable approach. And I think that we really ought to be taking a similar approach to consent. Like, I can sit here and say, in the model version of consent, you get consent for everything that happens to you very carefully applied. And maybe that is the ideal. Probably is the ideal. I don't know. I've wrestled with that even. Like, do we really need verbal consent for everything? And I'm like, probably not. But that's what I'm used to doing. And I feel bad if I don't. Like, I feel really awkward in any situation where I have not gotten, like, clear verbal consent. I'm like, yeah, that doesn't feel, like, good to me. That said, like...
But also, I mean, not to completely throw water on that, but that's also, you know, even in that view, it's necessary and not sufficient because, you know, you might have slightly different meanings of certain words when you get verbal consent, right? Like, well,
yeah, I mean, the other big factor, which is alcohol, right? Or at least intoxication.
Sure.
So especially when we're talking about sexual consent, you know, I dug and dug through the numbers, and the vast majority of encounters with new people, at least one of the people involved, and usually both, is not sober. And so either we have to change that norm.
Good luck.
Right. And I checked, that one is not just America. In fact, if anything, it's more in other countries. People are more drunk in other countries. So either you have to change that norm, or you're going to have to start toning down your expectations about what plausible good consent looks like. Because, you know, drunk people aren't amazing at consent, and they're not amazing at getting it, and they're not amazing at giving it. And so what then is good enough consent? That's where I start talking about harm reduction approach in the book. What does good enough consent look like? And I don't think I have an answer for it. I don't think Remy has the answer for it. I think what we desperately need is to have a cultural conversation about this, and one that doesn't start with the naive assumption that everyone in any sexual interaction is, you know, sober. And, you know, one of my sort of appalled responses that had also originally fed into the days of formulating this book, which should tell you how long it was percolating for, because this was from a long time ago. There was a public, like, sort of service campaign that went on a while ago now that was about tea.
I remember this, yeah.
I was trying to convince people that, you know, you should understand that if someone says no, if you offer them a cup of tea, that you wouldn't just keep trying to get them to drink tea, and that sexual consent should somehow be like this. And I was like, actually, I feel like this is a better metaphor than the people who invented it understood, but not for the reasons they thought. It's like, what are the things that go into whether or not you say yes to drinking tea that someone's offered you? You're like, will they feel bad if I say no? Mm. Like, am I supposed to drink tea right now? Is this the right time of day for that? Will people look at me funny for drinking tea? Like, what are all of the social ramifications for saying yes or no to tea right now. And I think that actually has a huge impact on whether or not people say yes to sex, right? They care about what the other person thinks. They care about what their friends will think. They care
We didn't get into this in the book, but I wonder, you know, how much conversation around kind of people who don't drink alcohol and kind of go into social situations and have to figure out how to not make a scene out of not drinking alcohol,
right,
informs that view of that metaphor.
Absolutely, right. I mean, I'm someone who doesn't really drink. And same. So, like, I have a lot of experience. I have a lot of experience with being in context and saying no to alcohol. And I'm happy to say that, at least in my life here in America, the vast majority of the time, no one asked twice. But that's mostly because here in America, people like assume that you're sober in the sense of you used to drink and now you've quit, basically. Mm-hmm. David Sedaris is sober, and he writes in his book about living in France and saying that in France, nobody gets it. And like, if you say no to alcohol there, people will just keep trying to make you drink it.
Right. No. There's the tea metaphor.
Yeah, for sure. And it's like, and I think it's a good metaphor, but not for the reasons necessarily that they thought. I agree. I think that offering people alcohol is probably a better one for understanding that, because also that's much more shaped and constrained by other, especially religious social expectations.
Sure. I think, you know, the other thing that this brings up is kind of, I don't want anyone to think that we're so naive as to think that we are going to have an enlightened societal discussion and fix things. and I think, you know, that there are different levels of conversation. And I think that the tea meme was pitched at a, you know, at a very different audience than the one that, say, our book is pitched at, even
for
if,
sure.
if the metaphor has some leverage, some use for us that are not necessarily the ones that kind of, you know, the tea meme was really meant to kind of get at, no, like wearing down somebody's resistance is not really the same thing as enthusiastically saying, oh, yes, I would love a cup of tea.
Yeah, they are very different things, right? And so it is swell for trying to frame that one simple thing. But the problem is that when it comes to sexual consent, that oftentimes things just aren't very simple, and they often are very drunk. And so I think I also do say in the book, in reference to that tea idea, is like, what if one drunk person tries to offer tea to another drunk person? Like, what does that look like? And so little of our cultural conversations about consent have really addressed that there's just so much intoxicated sex happening. The other thing I will say, if you're a listener, as I did more research into this, the quality of drunk sex is not good. I was really, as someone who is like, I've never been drunk in my life. And so I was like, okay, but people are always talking to me about, you know, their drunk sex. So now I'm kind of curious, like, is this actually any good? Because usually when I ask them about it, they don't seem like they thought it was all that great. And so, sure enough, on surveys, there's a fucking straight line correlation between how drunk each is. Like, was one person toxic? And this is both how drunk were you and how drunk were both of you, right? So like, you can just see like a straight line.
Is there some kind of Balmer peak in that data? I'm just curious.
A Balmer peak? What does that mean?
It's from programming. I'm going to mess up the history here, but there's some idea that like a little bit tipsy people program better because some of their like neuroticism gets pitched down and they just actually do the work. So like there's a little bump where quality of work gets better after like one drink and then it drops dramatically.
No, it does not.
That's really interesting.
It did not. And I also had thought that that might be the case.
Yeah.
And as far as I could tell, part of it is that basically, like, the more attracted people are to one another, the less likely they were to be intoxicated.
Sure.
And so, like, a huge overlapping factor there is just, like, the more intoxicated you got, the less likely you were to be having sex with someone you were very attracted to. Which
that's fascinating.
Yeah. Yeah, I know. As I recall, that accounted for like a huge percentage of that overall dip in quality. And so I don't know what it would look like if you controlled for level of attraction and then added in slightly tipsy as a variable. But definitely, I mean, these data were both funny and depressing in like how much alcohol did not improve sexual satisfaction. And also, of course, like people report that like they're just less good at doing the sex, especially men say that they're less good at doing the sex once they're intoxicated. And so it's really fascinating to me that, again, across cultures, this is such a thing across rich cultures, in spite of the fact that it doesn't seem to make everyone like sex more. So I'm just going to conclude this particular episode, and then we're going to go on into the next episode to get into some of the nitty gritty stuff from our book with some stuff that surprised us as we were writing this book, because, you know, I spent a lot of time researching this book, but I had never conducted like my own independent research on sexual assault. And so before this, I didn't like go out and do a bunch of interviews with people, for example. And so the book is largely me summarizing a pretty vast body of literature, which often hasn't been talking to each other because unsurprisingly, sociology often just doesn't talk to legal scholarship. But this is also separate bodies of sociological research. So it's gender researchers not talking to legal sociology researchers, for example. But one of the things that really surprised me as I wrote this book was that we talked earlier that saying the statistics were bad. They were so much worse than I ever had imagined. And worse than that, these completely nonsensical statistics have just made their way into popular discourse with no foundation.
Listener, this did not surprise me.
I was grimly shocked. I confess I had more faith in my discipline than this. But I was surprised. The thing that surprised me the most is that to the best of my knowledge, which I have to put huge asterisks on this, to the best of my knowledge, there are no nationally representative statistics on conviction rates for crime in America since 2006. And that's true for rape, it's true for theft, it's true for murder. I dug and dug, and I found these rates for England. So I'm pretty sure I was looking in the right general places.
I mean, one of the problems there, of course, though, is the one that we keep coming back to in this episode, which is that how do you even control for what a murder or what a rape conviction is when you have 51 different sources of law?
Yeah. It's well, someone used to try back in the day.
But like then that data has its own problems and is probably useless in its own way.
Oh yeah. And so, you know, one of the big problems that plagues some of that data with regards to sexual assault in particular is it's like the only thing where they have this like particular form of judicial discretion, basically, that like pretends like they've addressed it when they haven't, when it's been reported to the police. And so that shows up in the numbers as like, oh, we did something about it, when in reality they didn't. So there were these like non-existent statistics on conviction rates, and the most popular reported ones, I checked again and again and again, the most popular reported ones are from the website RAINN, R-A-I-N-N. And in an 8-point font that I desperately wanted to replicate in the text of our book, it's like got this tiny, tiny caveat underneath that's like, well, we don't actually know what these numbers are. We've just estimated on top of an estimate on top of an estimate on top of an estimate. And then everybody has been citing it for like decades. And then only relatively recently did they add to their website, well, we also tried to do the same calculation for other crimes, and actually conviction rates for other crimes isn't that different, which is what I kind of suspected going in, but I had not expected going in that, like, we just didn't have the numbers. I was like, oh, maybe no one's bothered to calculate them. I did genuinely try to look into calculating them for, like, a specific state or something. But actually so few sexual assault cases even go to trial or like get to the point where there would be a conviction. I particularly was interested in looking at like the rate of conviction in a jury trial, for example. But there's just so few of them that you can't even calculate that number.
But also by the time you get to a jury trial, like the system has self-selected in certain ways that makes it completely non-representative of anything.
Oh yeah. Well, all it would represent is likely you were to be convicted at a jury trial, which was all I was curious about.
Likely to be convicted with a million other factors that include that your case is probably better than the ones that are pleading out.
Of course, of course, of course. And but those numbers do exist for England, but they do not exist here in America, to the best of my knowledge. Another one that really surprised me as I was doing this research were the statistics on race. And it's always very hard statistically to prove a negative. That's just kind of the way science works in general, but especially the way statistics works. And so I kept digging because I was like, oh, I'm a sociologist and they always tell us that race matters and everything that I would read in this area, especially that had been written by a certain type of sociologist, invariably started with race matters so much in the way that cultural imagination understands sexual assault, which I was not completely on board with, but I was like, I think it matters a fair bit. And then it turned out that in practice, I could find no statistics to back this up. And I hunted for a few months, digging and digging and digging. And again, study after study was like, no, it just doesn't matter. And it hasn't mattered since like, I don't know, the 80s or something. Like, there definitely is an era where it matters a lot, which is why you get a lot of publicity in the early 2000s around, like, certain cases where black men had been found guilty when they weren't, right? And almost all of those were stranger rape cases, and then they were exonerated, and there was a lot of publicity. But those were all a very long time ago and before DNA was used. But, like, basically since DNA has become common in stranger rape cases, which is really where it's relevant, then the difference in terms of race has just largely gone away. This was in terms of who's the victim. And that's, like, on a college campus, not reported to the police, or in terms of reports to the police. And then the part that really blew my mind is the people who are the most likely to report any violent crime to the police are, like, poor black people, which was again just completely in contradiction to the way so much of the theorizing in this area had assumed. And then on top of that, then having dug and dug and dug trying to find any effect whatsoever from race and mostly coming up with next to nothing, finding huge effects in this literature from sexual orientation, especially being bisexual, and that's a very consistent finding, which is again not something that this literature really has broadly imagined at all, like why bisexuals would be sometimes literally double digits more likely to experience sexual assault of some form, especially stranger sexual assault, which is extra hard to come up with an explanation for. Like, so those were some of those numbers that really blew my mind, that I spent a long time just trying to defend to myself, even because they felt really foreign.
Right. And all of this does come with the big footnote that, like, all of the data is kind of several levels of caveats deep, but even with those caveats, it's some of what looks like it is true. It is unexpected.
Yeah. I mean, and so also when it, like, as I was doubting a lot of those numbers really hard, I was looking through them. So the homicide statistics do not have external validation. And this is why, like, the Washington Post maintains, I believe it's the Washington Post maintains, but government statistics on racism and homicide are, according to them, like, basically just full of lies. There is no way to externally validate those whatsoever. So I was like, oh, you should definitely approach government statistics about homicide, specifically race and homicide, with a lot of skepticism. However, sexual assault statistics have a lot more ways to externally validate them because, well, the victim usually isn't dead. So we have reporting from, like, nationally representative surveys, one that's been taken every year for many years, the NCVS, don't ask me what that stands for off the top of my head, National Criminal Victimization Survey, I think, but also, like, multiple, you know, even just college surveys that are, this is the people on this campus, right? There's a lot more ways to measure this than just what the FBI wants you to know and what the police have told them. And yeah. so the NCBS even asked, like, did you report it to the police? Did they actually investigate? Like, it asks those types of follow-up questions. And so there's a lot more reason to believe that the rape numbers are good than the murder numbers are good. But that said, these aren't my numbers. I didn't collect this data, right? And so it's like, well, I try to keep caveating in the book of I might find out later that these people get discredited. Like, this definitely happens, right? So who knows that for now? But this is with the available information, these numbers really blew my mind. It was like that prison rapes are so different than we imagine them, where actually, again, these are definitely somebody else's numbers, but suggest that, like, women who are prisoners rape each other more than men who are prisoners, and also that female prison guards are often guilty of raping prisoners. The last thing that surprised me a lot as I was writing this was that the American state that had, in my opinion, the most nuanced laws of the ones that I did, and I was not doing by any means a comprehensive survey. I was doing cursory glances, but I was still very impressed with the sexual assault laws in Texas. And I was like, Texas in America tends to not be like a very liberal, forward-thinking state. But they actually had like a fair degree of nuance on the way that they included some degree of like intentionality. They included like way more sophistication in the way that men could be raped, a lot more than, say, the state of New York,
York's a mess.
Which Remy worked.
That doesn't actually surprise me. Texas has its issues, and I think thinking of Texas's legal system, you kind of have to think of, like, there is the political part of it where things are a complete mess, but then there's also, like, Texas has one of the more sophisticated and kind of, for lack of a better way of describing it, like, earnest legal systems trying to solve certain problems. And it is kind of on the cutting edge of a lot of things, like anti-slap law. Civil procedure in Texas is really, like, they have well-developed case law on, like, complex issues. And, you know, at the height of the pandemic, Texas was one of the first states and kind of the only state really keeping legal proceedings open and moving things forward with remote hearings, because they are on the forefront of using technology.
Fascinating.
Texas was having remote bench trials within 3 weeks.
Huh.
And, you know, some states, New York, I'm looking at you, basically shut down their legal systems entirely for months.
Yeah, I was impressed with my brief glance over their penal code that it was also, like, way more cohesive than, say, California, which is also a very liberal state, and their sexual assault laws are fucking harass.
If you're a prosecutor with a case that looks a certain way and you want to get a rape conviction in Texas, you also have to have a Texas jury, which...
Yeah, it's got its own troubles. All right, so that's going to wrap up our first episode talking about our book. And then we're going to dive into some of the nitty-gritty details of our book in the next episode. Thanks for being on here, Remy.
It's been a pleasure to be here.
And thank you for listening.